This episode is brought to you by Interactive Brokers. And here's a question for you. Will the U.S. Consumer Sentiment Index exceed 70 in April 2025? At Interactive Brokers, the yes forecast contract was recently priced at 29% and the no was at 69%. IBKR Forecast Trader lets you use exchange-listed forecast contracts to trade your opinion on yes or no questions on future events like climate change, like the economy, or even politics. You choose yes or no, and if you're right, you get paid. It's that simple. Interactive Brokers forecast contracts are commission-free, and you earn a dollar for every correct prediction. Plus, you'll earn 3.83% APY on your investment with an interest-like incentive coupon, and you'll get $3 when you start trading forecast contracts. Now, forecast contracts are not suitable for all investors. Check out the data, spot the trends, and make your prediction. The best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Go to IBKR.com/forecast and start predicting today.
The disciplined investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Boom, tech earnings. We got a few big winners in there. Some concern on other areas. GDP goes negative. Jobs numbers, some issues in there. Yields are down. Tax season has ended, but it's really never over, is it? And we'll discuss that with our guest today, Dan Pilla, author of How to Win Your Tax Audit. All this and much more on episode number 919 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. April showers bringing May flowers, or is it maybe sell in May and go away? Maybe neither of those, and maybe it's both. Who knows? Welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm Andrew Horowitz, and there's absolutely plenty of action in the markets these days. If you haven't noticed, things are moving around pretty quickly, and that's because of all the uncertainty and the inability for really anyone to get a handle on price discovery, because the information that's coming out is so different and ever so quickly changing on a daily, minute by minute, hour by hour basis. This one is in, this one is out. We think that the hyperscalers are having problems, then boom, all of a sudden, you know, Microsoft and Meta come in with some great numbers and looking at CapEx spending that is pretty good compared to where people thought it was going to be. That was the big issue that was going on with the big turn, rolling over, I'll call it, that happened in the beginning of the year. And the subsequent rolling over when there was some concern that Microsoft was slowing down some of their spend and not taking on new contracts for builds. And all this was now all of a sudden a concern for everybody, all the tech names out there. And then some of the conflicting reports about what was going on with NVIDIA and how that was playing out also was starting to tarnish the image of the Magnificent Seven.
The Mag Seven.
Eco, well, that's a little bit of a different story. In the economic front, we're definitely seeing, I would say, a slowdown. Some are calling it the best ever negative GDP print. That was Navarro. Of course, those are the same people that won't look at some of the old numbers in a positive print and just adjust them, right? They won't look at some of the things that we saw, the pull forward that happened that caused the negative print this quarter, and look at the pull forward as last quarter as a one-time and should be adjusted. No, we just say, you know what, the pull forward is from last month and we're going to leave it in there, but we're going to take it out of this month. Kind of what Tesla did. You see the story? What Tesla did with including the gains on their Bitcoin in last quarter's earnings release, but extracting it from the adjusted earnings in this quarter because it was down. $97 million loss. They said, you know what, it put in the footnotes somewhere. So this pull forward that's going on that a lot of people have been looking at, of course, because people were buying and doing things ahead of the tariffs, and there's a lot of manufacturing that was happening, and things were looking good, and therefore it was much better to buy then than wait, so why not? And that pull forward really is having an impact. Whatever excuses want to be given, I just like to look at the raw data and find out what exactly is going on so I can make intelligent decisions on all this. There's no reason trying to make excuses, which is this rationalization process that goes on with markets and analysts, economists, and in particular with politicians blaming Biden on this economy and maybe even to next quarter. But if it was good, taking credit for it. Talking about the greatest stock market ever under this one or that one. I'm talking about whether it was Biden or whether it was Trump. It doesn't matter. They all take credit for what they want to take credit for selectively. That's the point. The selective use of what's good for me, what makes me look good. That's what I'm going to tell people. If you did that in the investment business, the SEC would be down your neck so fast. If you were to say, hey, you know what? We have an average return of 18% per year if we take out the losing years or something like that, right? If you saw a mutual fund do that or a hedge fund do that, the SEC would be fining them and putting them out of business immediately. If you were to talk about only the good commentary and not the bad on Yelp if you were a restaurant, you'd be shut down, right? Somehow, if you were to just show that. I mean, this kind of thing is the way that it goes, and then how we accept this. And maybe not all of us do, but we have to look at this objectively. That's how we make money in these markets. That's the whole point. Not about the politics, not about the restaurants, not about the returns that I was talking about a second ago. It's the objective looking at both the pluses and the minuses, putting it together, making a rational decision, and then making a very informed choice. But in any case, there is definitely something going on that's a bit off in the economy. And that's something that the markets have been, I would say, and investors sniffing out for some time now. And the volatility that we saw last Wednesday, that was pretty interesting. Market was down about 2.5% after the GDP print came out. It wasn't pleasant. It was a negative print, which I would say is probably right in line with the fact that we are probably going to have recession. It doesn't have to be a deep one, a long one, but at this point right now, as we stand here with what is going on in the economy, the uncertainty over tariffs and what is happening, and especially what happened with the stock market the first few months of this year, a recession is probable. Now, whether or not the Fed's going to come in and kick it, we got some numbers I'll share with you in a second about that, and reduce rates. Well, okay. Again, how deep it is and how long it is, that is really what the discussion is all about right now. But what we saw on Wednesday was a turnaround from about a 2.5%, I think it was exactly 2.4% downstroke in the S&P 500 to just about even, and then actually went positive. And then we saw on Thursday that number come out from Thursday night, Meta and Microsoft, pretty good. And then, of course, we saw Amazon, Apple, all these other ones come out, and they kind of made a mishmash of the markets after that. But the point is that when we look at the GDP print, people are really concerned. We saw that the probability of a rate cut in June moved to 57%. That's not an overwhelmingly high, or I wouldn't even say it's something to look at and get excited about. But when we now look a couple of months later, and we see that the September probability of a rate cut is 87%. So once again, the markets are betting on rate cuts coming. The two-year treasury is now lower than the Fed funds rate, and that is seen as a current circumstance where we are in a restrictive stance and a restrictive monetary policy. And that is helping to slow things down or hurting economic growth with all the other things that are going on. But the problem is there's still this little bitty pesky thing, this small little item of inflation that we have to deal with, because PC numbers came out this week and some of the details inside of GDP that clearly showed that inflation is still here. Or I should say that disinflation is no longer around. The inflation is really not moving up a lot. A little 0.1, 0.2. It's definitely not moving lower. And that's where we have some of these brewing concerns. Whispers that there's going to be a big slowdown, that there's sometime even we're going to have shortages and we're going to have shelves that are bare, and this is going to all happen this summer. We saw port numbers that came out, 30% reduction this week compared to a week ago last month and the last few weeks in the port of Los Angeles, because production is down in China. 30% of the vessels have supposedly just said, we're not sailing. And that's something we need to watch, because that too is inflationary. So here we are in May, with all that as a backdrop. And the question I'm going to ask you is, what planning have you done? Now it's May. Differently than you had done and planned to do in January. There's some things that we do in January, like these New Year resolutions. A lot of times it deals with money and relationships, but in terms of money and the relationships with money. Are you keeping up with those New Year's resolutions? Like being smart with your spending? Like increasing your 401k plan contributions? Like repositioning and rebalancing your investments on a regular basis? Are those things that you're doing actively and other things that you set out to do? You paying off those credit cards at 22%, 24%, 27%? That is not a good investment right there. You're losing money. That rebalancing and repositioning of your investments, you can do it on a regular basis. It could be quarterly, it could be semi-annually. Some people even do it annually. But you get some really good benefits by doing that. This rebalancing process of moving money from the best performing into the lowest performing that maybe have better valuations, and doing that on a regular basis is a self-fulfilling dollar cost averaging into lower cost items. Buy high, sell low. That's what we talk about. That's what we love to do. So this is something to consider and reconsider on a regular basis. And if you're not doing it, you need to find a way to do this. Whether you find an advisor, whether you can find an automation, these are the things you need to do. You need a financial coach to make sure that you can do that. Again, a lot of ways to do that. But sometimes it really behooves you to have someone in your corner making sure that they keep your feet to the fire when it comes to your resolutions, the things that you should be doing, the best practices for your personal finances. You are your own company. You're the CEO. Who is your CFO? It could be maybe yourself, maybe your spouse, maybe a friend, maybe an advisor, maybe online. I don't know. But somewhere along the way, whether it's a financial coach, whether it's a personal CFO for Bob Smith Inc., this is something you really should be thinking about doing. You want to be proactive with your finances. Not overly, not to a point of being obsessively compulsive about it. But I think enough to let your money know that you're going to love it. You're going to take care of it. You're going to nurture it. And you're going to make sure that you, in fact, are going to do what is right for it so that it could do what's right for you. That's what I have to say today. Let's bring on our guest. And who is that you may ask? Well, it's Dan Pila. He's an expert in IRS procedure and advocate of taxpayer rights. He's the author of How to Win Your Tax Audit. His primary calling in the world of his business, well, it's a tax litigator. And he's considered America's leader in taxpayer defense and taxpayers' rights and IRS abuse prevention and cure. He's been on many times before because I think this is the time of year that we want to have him, right after tax season ends. And all right, let's get going with what we need to do. So this is a guy who is regarded as probably the country's premier expert in IRS procedures and general tax financial problems resolution techniques. This is what he does. He helps hundreds of thousands of clients solve personal and business tax problems. Let's bring him right on, shall we? So, Dan, how are you?
I am well, Andrew. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. It is a great time of year down here in South Florida. As you know, we're about to get into that season that is oppressively humid, and we have to kind of just either step inside most of the day, or do what I call the hippopotamus, which is just lay in a river, a canal, a pool, and just put water over your back the whole day.
Well, yeah, and you've got the opposite problem that we have in Minnesota. In Minnesota, it's the wintertime that's oppressive, and you have to stay in the house. Now, at least in Florida, you can go outside, get in a pool, get in a lake or whatever, and give yourself some relief that way. We don't have that luxury when all of our lakes are frozen.
It's always that question, like, what would you rather have, right? Would you rather have that heat? Would you rather be, I mean, God forbid, you know, deaf or blind? I mean, one of those crazy if-thens and all that. But I'm much more inclined for the heat. I'm not wrapped at all and ready for the cold.
The heat doesn't bother me so much, but I don't do well with the humidity. Yeah. My wife is particularly oppressed by the humidity, so she would not function well in South Florida for sure.
It's like a steam bath. You walk outside, you're like, oh my God. You know, you don't do anything. You actually can just stand and you're just sweating like a pig. It's terrible. <Sure. laughs> All right, let's talk about some things with regard to taxes. That is an important time of year because here we are post what most people think is the end of tax season, which I think you could probably tell me best of this. Tax season never really ends, does it?
Well, it certainly doesn't end for me, Andrew, because I'm in problems resolution as my career. We do some return preparation here in my office, but not much. That's not where we focus. We focus on people that have problems with the IRS, enforcement problems, audit and collection. So I've always said April 15th is tax audit season opener. That's when the IRS starts to attack the tax returns that have been filed, or for most people, the tax liabilities that were not paid. You know, every year there's about 3.5 to 4 million people that file a tax return without the money. And, you know, maybe it's a little bit of money, couple thousand dollars, which is relatively easily manageable. Sometimes it's a heck of a lot of money, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, or even six figures in some cases. So that obviously becomes very, very difficult to manage, or it can be difficult to manage. So it depends on the situation that you're in. But those folks now face the IRS's collection wrath, and so they need to deal with that.
You know, one thing I never really understood, April 15th, which is the day that you required, and actually there was a April 30th in some states was actually a date. Because it was some kind of catastrophes and floods and things like that and storms. But one thing I really never really, I can't get my head around is when you file an extension on your personal return, you're required to pay the taxes due, right? That's the basic thesis.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
But how do you do that?
Well, that's the $6 million question. It is how you're supposed to know how much you're going to pay, how much you owe if you haven't prepared the tax return. And you need an extension of time to prepare the return because you don't have all your documents and so forth together. Well, here's what the IRS will tell you. The IRS will tell you that you must have made estimated payments against your current year's tax liability based on last year's tax liability. So for 2024, your estimated payments must have been based on at least your 2023 tax liability. Now, what they will tell you is that you've got to pay 100% of last year's tax liability, which, again, in this example, would have been 2023, or 90% of the current year's tax liability, which would have been 2024, through estimated payments. Now, here's where it gets tricky. You, as self-employed people, you are required to make estimated payments on a quarterly basis as the year is proceeding through the months, right? And so here we are 2025. We're done with the first quarter of 2025. Every small business owner should sit down and construct their profit and loss statement for the first quarter of 2025, see exactly what their net business income is for that period, and make an estimated payment based on that. So you base your payment going forward in 2025 on your either your 2024, 100% of 2024, or 90% of 2025, whichever is less, right? And so if you're monitoring that on an ongoing basis, you shouldn't have this problem. Of course, the difficulty, Andrew, is that most small business owners don't do that. Most small business owners don't start putting together their financial information until at the end of the year. And now they might be January, February before they start putting it together. And then they realize, well, wait a minute, I need an extension. Okay, so they get the filing extension, but that doesn't give them a payment extension. So they must make an estimated payment with that filing extension that would have been based on the prior year's tax liability.
As long as it's, but as, if you did put in 100% of your estimates or 110 to be penalty proof, whatever the number is, or if your W-2s were the right number, but for whatever reason you're extending, you're still safe. You don't have to put more money in at that point, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. If you've got your arms around it, if you've got your arms around that 90%, 100% rule, then you're in very good shape. That's exactly right.
Right. But if you don't put in enough, the worst that's going to happen is there'll be some penalty, which is, you know, just get your taxes done as soon as possible is the point.
Yeah, exactly right. And the penalty is basically an interest calculation. It's a penalty equal to the interest on the money that should have been paid between the time that it should have been paid and the time that it was paid. Now, we can mention this, and this, of course, is a moot point now because we're past April 15th, but it certainly is a valid point going forward into next year. You can actually get, and most people have no idea that this is true, but you can actually get an extension of time to pay your taxes, all right? The filing extension, Form 4868, as we already established, does not give you an extension of time to pay the tax. But Form 1127, IRS Form 1127, is called an application for extension of time to pay the taxes. And if you submit that on or before the due date of the tax liability, which would be normally April 15th, you can get up to 6 additional months to pay the taxes without penalties.
Huh. What if you're a day late on that? Screwed?
Well, if you're a day late, then you're just out of luck. It's got to be filed on or before the due date of the return.
Yeah.
So you can't file that form now and get an extension for 2024. That ship has sailed.
But one question. Is there interest due on the excess money?
Interest is always due. You never get out
but,
of the
But wait a minute. Hold on a second. If I overpay to the IRS $100,000 in taxes, you know where I'm going with this, right?
I know exactly.
I overpay $1 million. I don't care the number. It takes some crazy number. I overpay. I file my taxes. I extend my taxes because I don't know why. I extend it so far. I go months into the future. I file my taxes. The IRS says, okay, we do owe you that $100,000 to $50,000 to $10,000, that million. How much interest do they pay me on the money they held for me?
There's a technical legal term for that.
Yeah.
Andrew, it's called squando. Zip, zilch.
Nothing.
Niente, as we say in Italian. Niente, yeah. Nothing.
Ungats, nothing. Ungats. So.
Ungats.
So the idea is obviously this is not, you know, breaking news. File your tax on time or early. Get it done, get it over with, do it right, and move on. I have some questions about...
Well, let me pull on that string for a minute, because you make a point that's valid, but that doesn't seem to sink into people's heads. You said it's not breaking news that the IRS does not give you interest on your refund. And you're 100% right. And everybody seems to know that. And yet, people continue to use the withholding system or the estimated payment system as some sort of a half-baked savings account. Yeah. It's the world's worst way to save money. It's the world's stupidest way to save money. You shouldn't do that because you're not getting any interest on your savings.
Right. It's like a Christmas club. What without any interest at all. But what people really kind of irks me is when people are like, oh, I got a return from the government this year. I got money back. I got money. Yeah. Like, what? It's your money. Oh, what do you mean? I thought the government gave me the money. No. This is money that you overpaid the government.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the understanding, or I should say the lack of understanding, is even worse than that. Because I'll ask my compliance clients all the time, well, how much did you pay in taxes that last year? And I get from wage earners, I get the answer, well, Dan, I didn't pay anything. I got a refund. Oh, is that so? Let's look at your W-2. How much was your refund? Well, I got $1,000, Dan. I got money back. Okay, great. Well, your W-2 says you had $5,000 in wage withholding. And you're telling me you got a $1,000 refund. So let me ask you again, how much did you pay in taxes last year? Well, and then that, you know, the palm of the hand hits the forehead. Oh, gee, I guess I paid $4,000. Yeah, I guess you did. But of course, it's not $4,000. It's more like $14,000, right, in most cases, right? Yeah. People get a $2,000 or $3,000 refund and they think they're getting this free money back from the government.
Yeah, how
they
great.
Don't realize that they got this money coming out of their check every single month that they never see.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about that, because that's one of the big mistakes that people have, or the misunderstandings that people have. What other mistakes, the common ones, do people make, taxpayers make, when they're doing their stuff that leads to audits?
Well, along those lines, let's talk about not adjusting the withholding, okay? Let's continue with this idea of over-withholding. People don't think they have an option, Andrew. They think that their employer is just going to take money out of their check and the amount is arbitrary and they're always going to take, you know, $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 more than they owe, and there's nothing you can do about it. And that's not true. The W-4 form that you file with your employer as a wage earner is what your withholding is based on. So if you've got substantial refund, you're allowed to adjust your withholding to reduce the amount of money taken out of your paycheck, therefore reduce your refund, therefore increase the amount of money in your paycheck every month. Essentially, you're giving yourself the refund every month. Now, the opposite is true as well. If you've got a situation where you owe a bunch of money at the end of the year, well, you've got to adjust your withholding upward. You got to have your employer take more money out of the check every month, and therefore less money in your paycheck every month. Therefore, you don't owe anything at the end of the year. The goal is to be at or near zero when you file your tax return. They don't owe you any money. You don't owe them any money. That requires ongoing maintenance, if you're self-employed, maintenance of your estimated payments, and for wage earners, maintenance of their wage withholding based on, you know, if you got a bunch of overtime or you know, you didn't work for a while because of illness or injury or whatever, this is an adjustable thing, right? So you can make these adjustments on an ongoing basis, adjust it for 2 months or 3 months, move it back this way, move it back that way, so that you're balancing your withholding to match your tax liability.
That's good stuff. I mean, that is a good point, because I agree that most people don't think they have any control of that. And it's as easy as calling up, if you work for a company, calling up the HR department, asking for a new form to fill out so you could change your withholding amounts. I would say that most HR departments probably can help you even estimate what that number would be when you do it.
Question about it. Yeah, absolutely they can. And there's a worksheet with the Form W-4 that allows you to do that as well. But I'm with you. I'd sit down with the HR department and say, hey, you know, give me some help here. Let's figure this out. I don't want a $6,000 tax refund at the end of the year. I want to take that $6,000 and invest it somewhere, or pay down debt, or, you know, do anything with it better than let the government hold it for.
Yeah, but here's the giant flashing warning sign here. If you do this, folks, if you go in and you change your withholding, and the amounts that you're going to be taking out each and every week go down substantially, so therefore you have a larger paycheck each and every week, each and every bi-week, or each and every month, you have to commit to doing something with that. If you squander that money, what's going to happen is at the end of the year, you'll have no tax refund, and yes, that is your money coming back, and you will have no additional savings.
Yeah, exactly.
You'll probably have the same credit card bill somehow, though.
Yep. That's exactly right. So, you got to have the discipline to save or invest the money. That's the thing. And I hear this from people. People will say, well, Dan, yeah, you're right. I don't get any interest on it, and it's not a great savings plan, but at least it's there. And then I'll say, okay, your goal is to save the money. What do you do with the refund when you get it? What do you do with the $4,000? Well, then they tell me they blow it, right?
Yeah.
They just blow the money. Well, so what's the point?
Yeah, what you got to do is basically here's the routine, and not to kill this point, but this is if five people listening do this, it's, I feel like, a major win. Okay, go and look at your withholding. If you're getting a lot of money back, change it. If the number goes from, I'm just picking a number, the number that you have, if it comes back at the end of the year, is $2,000, change your withholding so $2,000 less comes out of your paycheck. And then what you do is you immediately go and sign up for $175 per month, round number, to put it into some mutual fund, automatically deducted from either your account, or if you can do your paycheck. Or in a different way, I'll say this, go and increase your 401k deduction.
I was just going to say that.
Get a greater tax deduction because you're earning less money because the money comes out on a pre-tax basis from your 401k. And you just now saved yourself all sorts of money and you really optimized that whole withholding process.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's precisely correct. And it really is such a simple strategy, but so, so beneficial. And not only that, if you sign up for automatic payroll reduction for your 401k contributions, you don't have to worry about not having the discipline to send the money to the account manager, right? And you hit the nail on the head here, Andrew, as I expect you would have. The fact of the matter is, when you're contributing to that 401k, you get additional tax deduction for that, right? And so that comes off your adjusted gross income. So now you got a double benefit.
Right. So everybody should stop right now. Replay this section again. Listen to it. Write it down, act on it. I'm not kidding about this either. I'm serious. Act on this, because if there's one thing that you could do to benefit yourselves, that little bit of extra money that was going into the end of the year that you used to pay off something or do whatever, you could actually have that earning more money or even on a pre-tax basis, setting yourself up for a really secure financial future and bumping that up to a significant amount sometime, maybe 10, 15, 20 years, 30 years into your future. And you'll thank your current you. Your present you will be thanked by your future you. I think that's an important thing. Dan, I want to talk.
Andrew, as we rappers like to say, true that, dog.
True that, dog. men of our age saying that sounds stupid, by the way. Saying. I want to talk about a couple things. I want to talk about some tax strategies, IRS insights. I want to ask about the enforcement changes in recent years. I want to talk about some common mistakes, but hang on. We're going to just take a quick break and we'll get right back to it. Let me take a moment and talk about Interactive Brokers, because I don't want you to be fooled by, quote, zero commissions on crypto trades. Some brokers add a spread to the price you pay, but at Interactive Brokers, there's no hidden spreads and you'll pay much less than you would at Gemini or Robinhood or even Fidelity, because I want you to keep more in your pocket and trade crypto for less at Interactive Brokers. Now, of course, you know, trading cryptocurrencies involves risk and is only for individuals with a high risk tolerance and the financial ability to sustain losses. But compare other brokers' fees and see how much you can save at Interactive Brokers by going to ibkr.com/crypto. We're back with Dan Pila. Tax expert has a great book called How to Win Your Tax Audit. Also, we'll have all the information on how to get in touch with Dan if you need him. I hope you don't. I mean, I hope you don't. I hope you do need him. If you need him, I hope you go to Dan, but I hope you don't need him. Is that reasonable to say, Dan?
Yeah, it's very reasonable to say. No, nobody wants to take advantage of my services, but I'll tell you, if you understand how the IRS goes after a tax return, what they look for, in my book, How to Win Your Tax Audit, I have two chapters in there that show you exactly what the IRS does when they attack a tax return. In my book, Dan Pila Small Business Tax Guide, I show businesses how to avoid these problems. So if you take advantage of that material, you're not going to need me for tax resolution representation.
Yeah, good stuff. So let's talk about those common mistakes. We talked about this, we touched on it, but didn't get there. What are some of those common mistakes that people make that get themselves into an audit situation?
Well, first of all, understanding how the IRS selects returns for audit is important, because people think that the IRS selects a return for audit because there's automatically a mistake in the return. But that's not necessarily true. They use a sophisticated computer program that compares every line of your tax return with national and regional statistical averages for a person in your same income category and profession. If any one line of your return is out of sync with those averages, the difference is scored. It's called a DIF score, Discriminant Income Function System is what that stands for, DIF. All right. So the farther away you are from the average, the more likely it is you are to be audited. But just because the IRS selects a return for audit doesn't mean there's a mistake in the return. It means that the IRS is questioning the return and they want you to prove it. So here's where the mistake comes in. The biggest mistake people make is failing to keep proper records to support the deduction items or income items, for that matter, in their tax return. Two-thirds, Andrew, of all of the adjustments that happen in an audit are not adjustments based on cheating. They're not adjustments based on, you know, hidden income or, you know, under the table money or any of that sort of thing. Two-thirds of the adjustments are based on lack of records. The people don't have, and particularly small businesses, don't have the documentation to support the deductions they put on the tax return. So you've got to keep records of your income and expenses. That's the key.
Now, what would,
right
what would be what would you do to make it easy? Would you do something like using an online register of a checkbook that then can be like a QuickBooks or like a Quicken, something that you can have line by line and show what it is? Or are you talking about the actual receipts?
Well, I'm talking about both things. What you're talking about is the actual process of keeping an active and accurate set of income and expense logs that we would call a profit and loss statement. And you're right. That needs to be done by self-employed people, no question about that. They need to know on an ongoing basis what their income is and what their expenses are so they can compute their estimated payments properly. What I'm talking about is original source records. All right. So if you let's say you're a traveling salesperson and you run all over the northeastern United States selling your product. Right. So you're in hotels, you're in rental cars, you're buying plane tickets, you're buying meals on the road. All right. So you use your credit card for that. OK, fine. But you're not keeping the original source documents to demonstrate what the business purpose of the expense was and specifically the business activity that was conducted in connection with the travel, right? So that's something that has to be done. So yeah, you got your if you're keeping anything, of course, maybe you might have your credit card statements, right? The monthly statements, but the monthly statements don't necessarily contain the hard information that the individual hotel receipt might have, that sort of thing. So this is what I'm talking about in terms of keeping those original source documents that will show what your expenses are. Here's another example that has nothing to do with credit cards. It's got to do with mileage expenses, all right? One of the single biggest expenses that small businesses, self-employed people incur is the business use of their automobile. You're required to keep a contemporaneous log of your business miles, right? So if you say to the IRS, you're driving 10,000 miles a year for business, all right, you get a deduction for that, that's fine, but you got to be able to prove it. And the only way to prove business use of an automobile is with a contemporaneous mileage log that shows where you've driven and what the purpose of the travel was. If you don't have that, they're going to disallow your mileage expense. And it's huge, as I said, for most small businesses.
But what about things that, I mean, you take a Lyft or an Uber, there's no like receipt.
All right,
what do you do about, you take a Lyft or an Uber, there's no receipt. You just get, you just got your Lyft app. You got to, what are you going to do? You're going to give your Lyft app records somehow to the IRS?
Well, as I understand it, what little bit of experience I have with Lyft or Uber is they do send you a receipt. They email you a receipt, do they not?
I guess so, but you don't like, I mean, trying to access that and give that back to the IRS in a form that they could use, it would be monumental for someone who uses it on a regular basis.
Yeah, I suppose it might be a little difficult, but then the question is, what records are contained on the user app that you would have access to? Would you be able to print out like you can do with your Visa card or your Amex? Can you go on an Uber app and print out a log of your Uber activity that shows the payments and the travel? And then you go through the log and you make notes, the travel was for this business, the travel was for that business. See, the thing is this, you can't just go to the IRS and say, well, I travel all the time, of course it's deductible. And they're going to respond by saying, okay, that's fine. I'm sure you travel all the time, but the burden of proof is on the taxpayer. This is what we need to understand. The IRS does not have to prove that your tax return is wrong. You have to prove that the return is correct. And if you make a deduction on the tax, if you claim a deduction on the tax return, it's your burden to prove that that you've got original source documents to support your claim.
I mean, could you come into the IRS with a box of just rando receipts and say, hi, here it is, or do you have to organize it?
Well, you got to organize it because people think they're going to be clever and bring this box or bag into the IRS and dump it on the desk and say, here, knock yourself out. Well, you know, a third party that's going through your pile of records, Andrew, or my pile of records is going to have virtually no way to assemble those records in some meaningful way.
And by the way, let me interrupt. I think most people won't have any ability to assemble those documents into a meaningful way to present.
Well, if you got some guidance, you will. But the thing is this: if you used a CPA to prepare your tax return, for example, a tax professional tax preparer with a CPA enrolled agent, doesn't matter. If you use a professional, what you got to do is when you sit down with that professional, and I have maintained this for decades, that you got to sit down with that tax professional, and particularly if you're a small business, go through your Schedule C or go through your business tax return and make sure that you understand the numbers that are in that return that this CPA came up with. Now, here's the thing. Tax preparers don't put random numbers into tax returns. They put the numbers in the tax returns based on the documentation or based on the information that people provided. So when we do a tax return, for example, for a small business, we require that small business to come in here, that business owner, to come in here with a profit and loss statement, right? Show us what your income is. Show us what your business expenses are by category. Now, we don't audit that. It's not required that we audit that information, but we do look the client in the eye and say, is this information accurate? Do you have the documents to back it up? And the client looks us back in the eye and says, yes, we do. And okay, that's good enough for purposes of the return because we're not the record keepers, right? The client's the record keepers. But when they say they've got advertising expenses, they've got business interest expenses, they've got business meals expenses, they got travel expenses of X dollars in all these various categories, they somehow have assembled those numbers. All right. And so what we tell that client is make sure you keep these records organized in this fashion, just the way you came up with this profit and loss statement, for at least 3 years from the date the return is filed. I recommend 6 years from the date the return is filed. Keep those records. So if you're audited, you've got the information at hand.
Overwhelming. I'm just saying it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming for some people to do.
For some people, it's certainly more than any free people should have to put up with, Andrew. Right. There's no question about that. Right. I have maintained for decades that you can't have freedom and an income tax coexisting in the same society. One must necessarily drive out the other. And with the compliance burdens that the Internal Revenue Code places on the American people in general and small businesses in particular, it's outrageous. And to me, I cannot understand how people have put up with this for so long.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of what I know that people do, because we see their finances all the time, right? And that's what we do. And we know what's going on. And we work with the accountants and we work with their various professionals. But the idea that, and we keep incredible records for our clients on all, not only their investments and other things, but I always, as I'm thinking through this, and looking at what they do on an annual basis, you know, and they half the time they can't find anything.
Yeah.
That's why, if they can't find anything now, how are they going to find something 3 years from now? Looking back.
And you're exactly right. And it's a common problem. And I see it over and over again, as I said, with compliance clients. Well, I don't have this record. I don't have that record. The answer is, and I talk about this in How to Win Your Tax Audit, you got to keep the bleeping records. It's a burden that you simply have to assimilate. You got to wrap your head around it and say to yourself, I've got an affirmative duty to keep these records, and it's going to cost me money if I don't.
Yeah, that means that every time you go somewhere and fill up for gas or take somebody out or, buy a, maybe some supplies, you need the receipts. You don't really need to go crazy with that. But, you know, if you have office supplies, obviously. But certain things that are more questionable, like meals, like travel expense. You need to keep
because the IRS is going to take the position. If you put a stack of receipts on the table for meals, for travel, for car rentals, the IRS is going to assume that that's personal travel and therefore non-deductible. So you have the burden to prove that it is business travel.
Yeah.
All right. So when you got a receipt because you were in a restaurant in Boston, because that's where you went to see a client, you got to notate on the receipt with a contemporaneous note that you write with an ink pen. You know, I was out with Andrew Horowitz. We talked about business. We talked about IRA contributions. We talked about doing radio shows about IRS. That's a business discussion. Now I've got the contemporaneous record on the receipt that shows the date of the meal, the amount of money I paid for the meal, the person that I was with when I had the meal, and the nature of the conversation we had while we were engaged in the meal. that becomes a business expense.
Yeah.
Same thing with the tickets, with the plane tickets and the hotel room. And I'll just give you an example. Every single year, Andrew, we produce and have been doing this since 1993. We produce a 2.5-day continuing legal education seminar for tax professionals, attorneys, accountants, enrolled agents. I teach tax professionals how to represent their clients in front of the IRS. Every single year we have this conference in a different city. We've had it in Las Vegas about 15 times over the last, plus or minus 30 years. Well, if I go into the IRS with receipts for plane tickets and hotels in Las Vegas, they're automatically going to assume it was a gambling junket. All right. But when I put that together with all of the conference information that I have to show that we produce the conference and that I teach the conference, and we've got attendee information, and we've got the hotel conference room confirmations and all the rest of that stuff, that clearly proves a business purpose. So that's what you have to have. That kind of information is what you need to prove business travel, just as an example.
And one of the things I also recommend, and we're going to end on this because we don't want to lose the entire audience on some of this, to be honest with you, is that if you're in a small business, try to separate your credit cards and your different accounts. Utilize one credit card only for business. Like, make that a thing that you will not slip, you will not fail. That is only for business, so that you can at least have that separation between that and your personal life. I think that's I always say it's helpful, at least, to get it.
Well, it's not just helpful, Andrew. I would argue that it's critical.
Yeah.
Because what you're talking about is commingling, what the IRS calls commingling business and personal expenses. And so if you've got a credit card and you're running all of your charges through that credit card, regardless of what they are, all right, business expenses, personal expenses, expenses for your kids at their college, whatever the situation may be, you present a credit card slip to the IRS, a credit card statement to the IRS, again, they're going to presume that everything is personal. Whereas if you've got separate credit cards and separate bank accounts for that matter, all right, business income and expenses in one bank account, personal income expenses in another bank account, at least with respect to the credit card, you can look the agent in the eye and say, this is my single use business credit card. Everything on this card is business. Let me give you some examples. And now you can overcome that burden presumption that the IRS will say, wow, this is all personal.
Right. Now, over the last number of years, there's been a lot of money allocated by the government to the IRS. There was, $700 billion or something a few years ago to hire X amount of IRS agents and all that. That's been recently overturned. What is going on in terms of enforcement and changes, and what should taxpayers be aware of?
Well, yeah, there's a couple of things. First of all, you're exactly right. In 2023, under the Biden administration, the Congress passed the Inflation Reduction Act, which itself is a farce, but that's a different discussion. They appropriated $80 billion to the IRS.
$80 billion, it wasn't $700 billion.
$80 billion to the IRS over 10 years, right? Not all at once, but over 10 years as a supplemental appropriation, right? Their normal annual appropriation is about $12.5 billion. So they added another eight on top of that. So $22.5 billion. That the IRS is getting over that 10-year period of time, specifically to hire about 87,000 additional IRS workers, again, over that same period of time. Now, about a year and a half later, Congress clawed back 20 of that $80 billion. So it was carved down to $60 billion. Now, what's happening is this Trump administration with the DOGE. With the DOGE program is pressuring a lot of bureaucrats to quit or retire, right? And so that obviously is affecting the IRS as well. There've been about 15,000 plus or minus 15,000 IRS retirees here in the last probably 6 weeks or so. But here's the thing that's fascinating, Andrew, and I pointed this out when the Inflation Reduction Act was passed initially. The IRS, everybody's saying, well, the IRS is going to get 87,000 more employees. Well, first of all, that was over 10 years. It was not over 1 or 2 years. That was number one. Number two, in 2023, when that act was passed, over the next 2 years, 2024, 2025, 2026, about 30% of the IRS's workforce was eligible to retire. So that's the retirements that we're seeing right now. The people that are leaving the IRS were those that are eligible to leave the IRS anyway. And there was this problem that we're going to have this mass retirement level in the Internal Revenue Service, and I suspect in other government agencies as well, although I don't pay attention to other government agencies. But the fact is they were going to lose these people anyway. And so that's what's going on here right now, is we're seeing a lot of people leaving. Some, obviously, some sooner than they might otherwise would. Some of them are taking that 6-month buyout deal, no doubt about that. But the fact is that they were going to lose those people anyway as a result of their qualification for retirement in these couple of years.
So are they going to be replaced, though? My understanding is some of this is going to be pulled back a little bit.
Well, they're trying to pull it back. There's no question the Trump administration is trying to pull it back. And what we're seeing right now is an IRS that is down to about, down is really not the right word. They're at about roughly 95,000 employees right now. They were at just about 100,000, call it 6 weeks ago. But in 2023, when the Inflation Adjustment Act, Inflation Reduction Act was passed, they were down to about roughly 85,000 employees. So they're still up compared to what they were a couple of years ago. Now, here's the biggest problem with the IRS. And everybody's crying out, well, if we lose these employees, we're going to lose the ability of the agency to perform its core functions, which are to enforce the tax law and collect the revenue. The problem with the burdens on the Internal Revenue Service are not so much the fact that they're losing a few thousand employees, all right, of several thousand. I mean, I don't want to understate the number of employees. They're losing employees, no doubt about that. All right. But the fact of the matter is, what's causing the problems with tax administration right now in recent years, and I'm talking about the last plus or minus 10 years, is the non-core responsibilities that have been heaped on the IRS by Congress. And it really started in earnest. I mean, it's been going on for decades where Congress will give the IRS additional enforcement responsibilities that have nothing to do with taxes. Perfect example of that is the Affordable Care Act. The enforcement and administration of the Obamacare Affordable Care Act was put on the IRS. They're the ones who have to enforce it. That's got nothing to do with tax law. That's got to do with mandatory health insurance. All right. During the COVID era, starting in March of 2020, as you know, you probably know this better than I do, the billions of dollars worth of giveaway programs that were created by Congress, they were all administered by the IRS. All right. The IRS was responsible for the PPP program, and the IRS is responsible for the employee retention credit. And the IRS is responsible for the three, not one, not two, but three of the so-called stimulus payments that were sent out by the IRS during that period of time. Right. These are non-core responsibilities, and what the IRS refers to as mission creep, right? They're spreading the IRS thinner and thinner and thinner with these tasks that have nothing to do with tax law enforcement. Whereas if they would just allow the IRS to focus on its job, they wouldn't be overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, lots of change is going to happen. I have a sneaking feeling though that there's going to be a desire to slow the roll of what was originally thought to be funding the IRS to a point that they could actually bring in more taxes. And I think that's going to be something that's going to be put on the back burner in this administration compared to the last administration.
Well, you know, I certainly think you're right about that. And I don't think that's a bad thing, frankly. I've made this point, and frankly, I wrote about this quite at length during the discussion on whether or not Congress should fund the IRS to the tune of $80 billion and hire 87,000 more workers. I pointed out over and over and over again, I've said this a long time, that 98%, now this is a real number, comes from Treasury Department statistics, anybody can verify this, 98% of every dollar that's collected by the IRS is collected through what the IRS would call voluntary payments. Now, there's nothing voluntary about the Internal Revenue Code, Andrew, right? I mean, we don't have the choice to file a tax return or not file a tax return. So it's not voluntary in the sense that I can go to Florida or not go to Florida in January, right? That's not what I mean. What they define as voluntary compliance as the act of an individual fulfilling their obligations under the law without the need of IRS intervention. That's voluntary compliance, right? So what that means is 98% of every dollar paid into the Internal Revenue Service is paid in voluntarily, and only 2% of the revenue is paid in through enforcement action. So I have maintained all along that the IRS will get far more bang for their buck by helping taxpayers to comply with an increasingly complicated tax law rather than grinding them into powder through enforcement if they don't comply. People will tend to comply with a law that they understand, that's reasonably simple, if they know what they're supposed to do, when and how to do it. People don't want to get in trouble with the IRS. They want to stay. They want, nobody I know, Andrew, wants to get sideways with the IRS, right? Nobody wakes up one morning and says, how can I tick off the IRS today?
I know. Hey, my bucket list is to get an audit.
Yeah, exactly. That's on my bucket list. I want to be an audit. You know, this is absurd. People don't want anything to do with the IRS, and they'll do what they have to do to stay out of trouble when they can. So we've got a tax code now that consists of more than 4 million words that was changed more than 6,000 times just since 2001 alone. And that doesn't even count all the changes, hundreds of changes that occurred during the COVID years, 2021, 22, 23, right? All those acts of Congress that were pouring out that had tax consequences. So people get confused. When they get confused, they get frustrated. When they get frustrated, they throw up their hands and they don't do it. Oftentimes, they don't do anything. So the IRS will be far better off spending time and attention on taxpayer assistance, outreach, and education than they ever will on enforcement. And outreach, education, and assistance is far cheaper than enforcement.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. I mean, clearly, that whole argument of change the tax code, go to a level, go to more, you know, the more difficult it is, the more problematic it is, the less money you get in, to simplified, and it would be a lot easier because you need less enforcement, you need less people running it, but also people will just fill it out and it's done. They're not going to try to find loopholes, because the current tax code, the whole point is, if you just had a tax code that says, you know, you pay 15% of your income, well, what's income? It's just whatever you make, period, end of sentence. Versus, yeah, what's my income today? Well, it's this minus this, muscle, this times that, divided by that, plus this minus that, right? So it's a lot more fraught with potential. What is happening with the IRS, though? I mean, right now there's, what, 5 acting commissioners?
Well, there have been 5 commissioners since Trump took the reins as president in January. So since that time, there have been 5 commissioners. So Danny Werfel was the commissioner of IRS at the time that Trump took office. He stepped down. Trump made it clear that he wanted his own guy. Okay, so Trump nominated former Congressman Billy Long from Missouri to be the commissioner of IRS, although the Senate still hasn't even set so much as a confirmation hearing, never mind had, you know, any discussions about
Billy
Long.
They're busy, okay? They're busy.
Yeah, they're busy, and it's odd. We can talk about Billy Long as a separate subject, but I find it odd that Trump nominated him, but set that aside for a second. So they've had a number now of what they call acting commissioners. All right, guys that are doing the job that haven't been appointed by the president. We've had 4 of those step down. All right, 4 of those have stepped down, and now, well, I shouldn't say that. 3 of those have stepped down, and now we got the 4th one, a guy named Michael Falkender, who is an IRS guy. He's been worked for the agency for a number of years. He's worked for the Treasury Department for a number of years. He's got a tax, he's got an IRS background and a tax administration background. So he's in that position right now. He was appointed very recently here, last couple of weeks, he was appointed, and so he's at the reins right now. So we are still without a presidentially nominated and Senate-confirmed IRS commissioner, and that remains to be seen as to when that'll happen.
Yeah. Oh, it's a complicated world, this whole tax mess, and it's almost like a sigh of relief once we get past April 15th in theory, but then we know that we have to do this. I think we sum it up by saying that if you don't want to get in hot water, it's all up to you, right? It's all up to us as the,
yeah, it really
the
is.
Voluntary, you, as the voluntary taxpayers.
Right? Yeah, voluntary. Yeah. It's like the Vito Corleone definition of voluntary.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah.
Either your brains or your signature will be on the tax return, right? So and here's the thing. I think we just simply have to wrap our heads around the idea that this is an ongoing compliance responsibility. All right. It culminates every year on April 15th. But I'll tell you what, every time the calendar rolls over from December 31st to January 1st, guess what? You start over again. Right. You start over again with your record keeping, and you start over again saving your documents, and you start over again with your bookkeeping and all the rest of that. It's just an ongoing thing.
You know, you would I would, you know, I'm all in favor now that I'm just started thinking about this, is that the time wasted or time spent, however you want to look at it, on the record keeping should be a deductible item.
Yeah, yeah, you might think that,
you might think that's stupid, but no. What I'm saying is, like, when you drive, you get a certain, if you don't do your mileage, you do get a certain amount of mileage you can use for business, right? This is just a standardized thing.
But no. What's standard is you either can take the standard mileage rate, which is a fixed, you know, roughly about 74 cents a mile, or you can claim your actual expenses for mileage. But in either case, you have to document how many miles you traveled.
Uh-huh. No, I get that. I understand.
There is no standard mileage amount of miles that the IRS will just give you.
No, I get that. But I'm saying we should have some kind of standard rate for
the standard rate based on miles you prove is available.
Right. Standard rate based on the time spent on the administration and documentation on an annual basis for an audit that may or may not ever happen.
Well, and it's interesting that you say that, because in the instructions for every single tax form there is a Paperwork Reduction Act requirement that declares in that document how much time it takes to keep the records and to fill out the form for compliance purposes. So a Form 1040, for example, might be 2 hours and 12 minutes based on government estimates. A Schedule C might be 6 hours and 7 minutes. And it's interesting that you bring that up, because the National Taxpayer Advocate has a number of times over the last, let's say, 12 or 15 years, estimated the total number, used those numbers to calculate the total amount of time that people spend in tax compliance. And Andrew, it's upwards of 200 million hours a year that Americans spend making records and preparing tax returns and doing the enforcement thing. I mean, that is the economic equivalent of taking the entire productive component of the workforce in Michigan and Ohio and Indiana and just dropping it in the Atlantic Ocean. All right. It's complete 100% economic waste.
Unbelievable. Dan Pila, we're going to have all the information on the show notes for episode number 919 on thedisciplinedinvestor.com on how they can get in touch with you. Like I said, my hope is that if they do get in touch with you, I know it's a great resource and you're going to help them. I hope they never have to call you though.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Thanks so much. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. My pleasure, Andrew.
There you go. Everything you need to know right now about making sure you do what you got to do, about keeping your resolutions, making sure your taxes are up to date, making sure you can, I don't know, maybe audit proof yourself in a way by doing the things that you need to do. Dan Pila, great information. I got to tell you, sometimes talking about taxes is maybe like, oh, what are we doing that for? It's so boring. There's a reason. Minimizing taxes and making sure that you are protected is part and parcel of a solid financial plan, of making sure that your financial security is set. The last thing you want to do is wake up in 5 years from now, get an audit, not have any of your stuff ready. And then what happens? Chunks of your money go out the window. We're trying to keep all that in your pocket. That's what we're doing here. Make sure your investments grow as much as they can, optimizing them in every way possible to make sure that you have a sense of a security when it comes to your money. Each and every week on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Please make sure to go to Apple or Amazon or Spotify or YouTube or iHeartRadio or wherever else that you get these podcasts and put a nice rating down for us and a commentary. I really appreciate it. I will consider it a personal favor. Thank you for joining me this week. Thank you for joining me every week, every month, every year. I'll see you again really soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida, and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.
Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.